I gotta tell you about this girl I met. Nah, me and that work gal called it quits a few weeks ago. No, I wasn't ever serious. We hung out mostly when I was in Seattle. And she actually bailed on me because she wanted to start doing more charity stuff for the Orc Underground. Anyway, I was in Toronto a week or so ago, and I'm talking to some of the organizers of an anarchist cell group that I've been corresponding with about an idea I have. And they get a call about one of their own that had just been arrested. So they send me and this other guy down there to see what's up. When we get to the station, there she is, this elf chick with red streaks in her blonde hair, being dragged by her handcuffs into the building. And one of the guys mentions her being sinless and not in the system. And then she spit on one of the guards and she shouts, "Frag the system!" So I threw down an improved invisibility on us. We go break her out before she gets processed and given a criminal sin. Afterwards, I go up to introduce myself. She beats me to it and she says, "Hey, I'm Rose Red. Thanks for the save. Let me take you out sometime to say thanks." So I says, "You've had me at Frag the System." Not too shabby. Coming to you straight from the most reliably biased source on the Matrix, this is the Anarchy in Podcasting Network, and I am Opti. Welcome to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. Crows, we have hit a milestone. The support has grown to the point where I am now going to endeavor to bring you episodes of the Neo-Anarchist Podcast weekly. We're going to try out some new ideas over the next few months, given the weekly format. Some ideas will be great, and they will stick around, and some ideas will frag hoop, and they will be jettisoned. Either way, get ready for a new era. Now back to the anarchy. The year was 2064, the history was high, but first, the segment we have always called Dear Opti. Dear Opti, what are the lingering consequences of the Year of the Comet? From Poetics. Well, Poetics, the most noticeable effects of the Year of the Comet seem to be the surge cases and the upswing in metavariants and metaspecies. With the naturally occurring auric alchem gone and the mana back to relative normal, the living, breathing consequences are the most common nowadays. But, while not as visible as the metas, the alchera that have popped up here and there might be the more dangerous. These alchera are astral overlaps with our world, or ancient scenes replaying themselves. We don't understand them quite yet, but they do seem to be some auras of heavy mana, while others seem to overlap another world or another time with ours. Entire islands popping up, then disappearing or not disappearing, castles long gone popping into existence once more. These have been far more common since the comet than they were before. Now this next one comes from Mr. Clean. Dear Opti, a chum of mine wants to know, ever had a close encounter with individuals infected with HMHVV? Thanks, Mr. Clean. And the answer to that, Mr. Clean, is yes, I have. I'll say more about that in a future episode. Henry G. Chavez writes, Dear Opti, did you get that thing I sent you? No! No, I didn't! I never get that thing you sent me. I've never gotten that thing you sent me, and I'm beginning to wonder whether you ever sent me anything. Two episodes ago, Dakota Crooks asked about his corp job, and I told him to quit. Now he's back for another round. Dear Opti, I took your advice from last time, and I'm running now. So, do I need to get rid of my sin, or can I still run with one? Oh, sure, Crooks, you can still run with one. In fact, with a name like Crooks, you were born for it. Still, though, you may want to find someone who can burn that sin. While you run with one, if you get caught, someone sees you, they'll be held to pay. It's going to cost you, so I hope you brought some Nuyen with you on the way out. Moritz Schubert asks, Dear Opti, what is your favorite spot for a vacation in the Sixth World? Well, Moritz, I have to say that I really love Scotland. The Scotch, the greenery, the thin places, the powerful ley lines, the Scotch, the castles, the weather, the fish, the chips, the Scotch. Hell, I even like the Church of Scotland. And the Scotch. What's not to like? Besides the toxic zone. But hey, Scotch. Dear Opti, why? Wink emoticon. From Ivan Paramore. This one is easy. Because if we don't, who will? If not now, when? Because when the beating of your heart echoes the beating of a drum, there is a life about to start when the morrow comes. Dear Opti, do mentor spirits talk to each other? If so, about what? Do they vote on who gets magic and who doesn't? Can they be persuaded to change their decisions with these astral quests I hear rumors about? Or is that only that reality triz show, Those Crazy Totems, from Monday Night Fightball? Whoa, slow down there, Fightball. There's a lot of questions in that question. To start off, some totems do indeed talk to other totems. But not all totems talk to all other totems, and some totems sit in the corner alone. And no dreck, they do often talk about the weather. Totems do not actually have a say in whether or not someone is awakened, although I say that with trepidation because they can have an effect on the hows and the how muches and the whys of awakened power. It's not fully understood. It's like being in love. It's not really an on and off switch. It's mysterious. Sometimes comes first from one person and then to the other, or sometimes it's reversed. Sometimes it's mutual, sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's gradual, sometimes it's right away. There is no one way to explain magic and mentors. As far as astral quests, yes, they can have some relationship with your totem, although I'd be very careful to know your totem before you do something like that. Some totems, Coyote and Raven, for example, are known to be tricksters. And don't let me catch you watching those crazy totems again. I hate reality truths. As always, Crows, thanks for the questions. There are no dumb questions, just dumb runners who get geeked because they didn't ask questions. Now, just like last time, I want to split this episode in twain. Not least because there's a direct load of info here, but some of the events are so interconnected I don't want to muddy the waters trying to weave in unrelated items. So this time, you're going to get the geopolitics from 2064 and not much else. Here it is! In 2064, New Guinea was annexed by Australia, thinking it would stabilize the region, and also because they wanted their natural resources. Turns out, New Guinea didn't want to be annexed, and the Prime Minister declared it an act of war. Of course, he vanished into thin air just after saying that. The Australian-New Zealand Allied Confederation, or ANZAC, put down the bulk of the protest, and according to the state press, most New Guineans welcomed them with open arms when New Guinea joined the ANZAC. On January 11th, former director of research at the Metagenetics Research Consortium, Dr. Dieter von Kammelberg, gets himself geeked by a hit and run. Came to my attention that Dr. von Kammelberg's alias was The Nazi, central executive in the racist terror group Alamos 20,000. In February, a train carrying nuclear waste is hijacked and all the security officers killed. Green War operatives take responsibility. On March 14th, the Philippines gets a new ruler when Admiral Ryochi Kuroda is appointed new governor after the previous governor is assassinated. Once he gains access to the Imperial Marines, he quells the ongoing dissent using the old execution tactic. All dissidents are killed. On April 2nd, the Emperor of Japan, Yasuhito, marries Hitomi Shiawase, the granddaughter of Shiawase CEO Sadato Shiawase. And Hitomi is a former Shadowrunner. Now, pay close attention to this next one, Crows. There's going to be a test. On June 5th, Aztlan signs a peace treaty with the main Yucatan Rebels faction. However, all did not go smoothly. Juan Azcapotzalco, Aztechnology's CEO, is killed when a bomb ripped through the ceremony, seemingly by those wishing to hijack the treaty. Up until this point, Juan had been terribly mysterious, but also increasingly more troublesome to his powerful adversaries. And I should say that while this didn't get much press in light of Juan's death, the bomb conveniently killed the high-ranking Aztec shaman Quetzalcoatl. Still, the treaty is signed and Yucatan becomes an autonomous region. Now, there's a feathered serpent at the event named Pobre, one of the figureheads for the Yucatan independence, who was quick and public with an accusation that it was the great feathered serpent dragon Xibalchan who was responsible for orchestrating the assassination. It was not much later that Aztlan attacks, captures, executes, and even dissects Xibalchan, publicly, to make a point. In one dramatic season, the powers behind Aztlan and Aztechnology shifted greatly. With CEO Juan Azcapotzalco no longer in power, Aztlan president Flavia de la Rosa is appointed president CEO of Aztechnology. Flavia became much more public and seemingly a more open leader than Juan had been. And to fill De La Rosa's empty position, Enrico Silva won a special election to finish her term as Aztlan's president. On October 24th, Misuhama issued a press release to the effect that it would pull out all personnel from Tsimshian. Apparently, Misuhama was done exploiting Tsimshian's resources, but previously, Misuhama was one of the only things holding the country together. After this, Tsimshian teetered on the brink of collapse, while at the same time, the oppressed Haida population threatened government takeover. Months later, Great Chief Deborah Jim is publicly executed during the overthrow of the Tsimshian government by the Haida National Front. Sioux forces intervene and retake the country, and Tsimshian becomes a protectorate of the Salishi. Now, our focus is going to turn to the Middle East. A few episodes ago, I had mentioned that there was a new Islamic Jihad that had formed during the Year of the Comet. In 2064, that came to a head as follows. By early November, the Arabian Peninsula was in complete chaos. For reasons we'll talk about next time, communications throughout the region had been disrupted. As a result, power and water supply had become a problem as people everywhere began to panic. By November 7th, the Caliph had been trying to get services restored, but Ibn Isa, the leader of the new Islamic Jihad, was throwing wrenches into the plans to help by accusing the Caliph of being responsible for the chaos in the first place. It seems that sane Muslim Arabs were working to help, or at least trying to stay indoors away from the chaos, while Ibn Isa waged a campaign of violence and terror through the streets in the name of Islam. By November 15th, new Islamic jihadists bombed and terrorized cities while Arabian security was in disarray. At this time, Arabian Future Industries filed for bankruptcy and, along with the Caliph's other financial allies, became completely unable to help him retain stability in the region. A full-scale civil war began to break out. On November 23rd, the Caliph of Arabia is forced, by his own desire to limit further bloodshed, to surrender his powers to Ibn Isa and his new Islamic Jihad. He calls for a meeting of religious leaders and corporate executives from the entire Islamic world to meet and witness the transfer of power. By November 26th, a very interesting report had circulated globally. It seems that the Caliph had not intended on surrendering at all. In fact, once the assembly was gathered, the Caliph offered Ibn Isa the chance to rejoin the Islamic Unity Movement if he would repent and submit to punishment. At this, Ibn Isa was so shocked that his reaction revealed his true nature. The furniture around him rotted and a deadly aura appeared around Isa. When Isa attacked the Caliph, a brave guard took the blow. A battle erupted between dark spirits led by Isa and the Islamic scholars and guards. It became clear when Ibn Isa fled the palace and discussions began that Isa had truly died in 2061 and his body had been inhabited since then by a foul master Shadim. By December, Arabia was restored to order. Most of the new Islamic Jihad had dispersed to other areas of the world, along with most of the radical militant clerics in the region. At the end of the day, the company Global Sandstorm swept in to help, and now, along with Sadr Krupp, they bolster the region financially as things return to normal. Finally, in shocking news, due to world events, economic crisis, and the political revolution within its borders, the Shir Tarangira Council of Princes announced that it was disbanding at the end of the year and holding an election within the month to set up representative government. A month? Sure, that's enough time to set up and elect representative government. Sure. And that is it for the geopolitical history of 2064. But that isn't the only news that I'll leave you with, Crows. I wanted to bring back the Shadowing the Runners segment for 2064 just so I could get a chance to talk to you about Uncle Elwyn and this particular tale. Uncle Elwyn is small, but Elwyn is tall. That is for a dwarf. He makes his home currently in Seattle and appears to be a professional carouser. He usually is at the bar telling jokes, hitting on some ladies, upsetting someone, or maybe doing all three at once. He's not the best-looking guy in the room, but he's subtle on the dance floor and he's suave around the bar. He's quick draw with a lighter. He's a pseudo-shadow star. In fact, he's always spinning a tale about being a Shadowrunner back in the day. Some gullible wage slaves even believe him. But the stories he tells are too out there, and the details change too often to take him seriously. In reality, he actually was a prime runner back in the 60s. But he's been running dark, keeping a low profile, hiding in plain sight, and not running at all for the last decade or more. He put up his drones and burned his fake sins. But I want to tell you about the last run of Uncle Elwyn. The story's been told a million times, but never the same way twice. The corp, country, Johnson, and the job change, but here's the one that I like the best. Uncle Elwyn and a team consisting of Rev, an elven mage, Calibri, human matrix support, Blitzkrieg, a human street sam, and Karzai, an elven adept, got a call to go down to Ozatlan to hear a job offer. A pretty big sum, in fact, just to hear an offer. And they were requested for by name. They ended up accepting, and they found themselves in natural tunnels under Tenochtitlan, told to dig a tunnel until they hit an abandoned building. Rev was keeping an eye out on the astral, and the others kept guard duty or ran supplies, while Elwyn used his drones to dig. After 2 weeks, they hit a facility, and Mr. Johnson came down and gave them more details. Hidden inside was some sort of magic artifact, the details of which went over the team's head, but made Rev pretty fraggin' uncomfortable. They headed down unstable corridors and sections begging for reasons to collapse, but based on the retro print magazines they found, the last time anyone was down there was in the late 20s. It seemed odd that with so much destruction and so much personal effects, they didn't find any human remains, but the chronology of the collapse there started to make more sense since Tenochtitlan was rocked by a big quake back in 29. They figured that the place probably got hit hard, and the bean counters decided that whatever didn't make it out wasn't worth the effort to dig. After that, they figured that they were directly under what used to be the old Metropolitan Cathedral. That led to some head-scratching, especially for Rev, who was a minister in his day job. The astral static they were getting reeked of blood magic, and while they felt secret bases under old cathedrals was straight out of the Vatican's own playbook, blood magic wasn't. According to Rev, the whole blood magic thing wasn't something that they would ever partake in, without exception. In fact, the church's public and private opposition to the whole human sacrifice thing was one of the reasons they were kicked out and hunted down in Azatlan. Based on what they gathered and what Rev was seeing on the astral, they theorized that Azatlan had built this place over the Metropolitan Cathedral in order to hide the blood magic signature on some nasty stuff. The funny thing was is that during the quake of 29, the epicenter was centered right on the Metropolitan Cathedral. At the same time, several thousand people went missing. Also, several thousand were killed by the quake. Now, quakes kill a lot of people, but several thousand people going missing seemed a little much. They were just finishing up in the tunnels when they had an unexpected visit from their Mr. Johnson. Johnson told them that the socio-political situation in Azatlan was deteriorating rapidly, and they needed to leave immediately with the evidence that they had gathered and head to Denver. Calling it evidence didn't sound good. Neither did the all-of-a-sudden change in the Johnson's attitude. As the Johnson was about to explain, Calibri cut in and told the team that there were troops descending into the caves. They began to announce via loudspeaker that they were going to arrest the dragon Zibalchin. The Johnson, looking more than a little irritated, took off his ring, tossed it to Rev, and gave the runners instructions to head to a nearby underground river and take the artifact they find to Denver, where he would meet them. The Johnson turned around as if to hold off the entire group of soldiers. When pressed as to why they should bother, Johnson turned around and gave the most practiced condescension, told the team that he was giving them one chance, to either do what he says and survive, or lose their usefulness and be given up to whatever authorities want them. Further, he added that the ring is the key to a dragon horde, his horde, and that they are welcome to take whatever they can carry. The runners agreed to those terms. After encountering several waves of Azatlan troops and either hiding, tricking, or killing them, they made it back to the safe house. Rev was able to track down the horde through the ring's astral connection with it, and ended up being more like a cache, but more than enough for them to take their fill. They had the artifact, they were leaving the cache, and they were confronted by the dragon Zaqualtipan, who claimed to be the sister of their Mr. Johnson Zibalchin. She knows they were present when they were taken by the Azis, and negotiations broke down when they were found to have loot from the dragon's horde on them, and they only escaped by luring her back into the cavern and the sacrifices of at least one team member. Truth be told, only Elwyn and Rev made it out of Azatlan alive. Hostagnology wants the artifacts they rediscovered. Azatlan wants them dead for knowing the truth of what happened back in 29. Zaqualtipan blames them for Zibalchin's death, and all three of them are intent on seeing them dead. Since then, Elwyn has at least been in hiding in plain sight for at least a decade. He changed his face and fingerprints, trashed all of his old identities except for one, and even went as far as to cashing in a Dockwagon gold contract to replace his cyberlegs with meat versions so he wouldn't be recognized as the offending Shadowrunner. Soon after they returned to Seattle, Zaqualtipan began sending out agents to snoop around for the dwarf and the Christian mage who she felt were involved in her brother's death. But as far as whether or not any of that's true, only a few people know. But what you can know is that you have wasted an entirely good slot of time listening to the Anarchy and Podcasting Network. In closing, I want to give a hearty hello to our newest Patreon supporters, which receive monthly offerings of Neo-Anarchist Street gear. Freshly included in this illustrious list of capable crowfunders is Benjamin Teeter, Stu Skeel, and Faster Nate. Thank you all. Everything you need to set up and maintain a Neo-Anarchist cell in your area, which at various levels now includes stickers every month, patches, dice bags, fake IDs of all sorts, contact sheets for Opti and his crew, USB cred sticks, whiskey glasses, and an upcoming album full of sixth world musical malarkey will be delivered to your safe house as we march bravely on. The music serving as the background to Audible Anarchy was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unanunium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. And I was your host, the volatile violence vaccinator, variably vanquishing villainous veils, valiantly vocalizing, violating verbatim vernacular vocalizations, vibrant vacillating between vats of vital vitamins, velvety vino vines, and valorous vanilla vodka. vehemently voiding vitriolic vertigo Valkyries, voluminous, vulgar, verbose, vaporous, vagrant, and voyaging with vegan vampires, Opti. Enjoy your freedom, as long as others can do the same.